You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, November 4th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Tea Party has taken over Kentucky for good. Also on the program, Ohio will not legalize recreational and medical marijuana. Pennsylvania Supreme Court swings Dem. Virginia still purple. In Houston, hate wins. And in New Jersey, Chris Christie loses. Overall, not a particularly joyous evening for progressives. A couple of bright spots. You have to go all the way across the country for some of those. Also on the program today, we'll get to that charter story. More research shows that the Success Academy approach to disciplining kids not terribly effective when it comes to educating them. Meanwhile, Bernie Sanders, after calling for an end to the death penalty the other day in the Senate, now calls for an end to fossil fuel development on federal lands. People are beginning now to question, is Ben Carson simply a con artist? I will tell you the answer. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, even someone as caustic and emotionally removed and at arm's length from his own feelings, even someone like I am beginning to feel bad for Jeb Bush. Meanwhile, one half of all black millennials reported a couple of years ago that they know a victim of police violence. And Anthony Kennedy has just a tiny moment of clarity, but it in no way has influenced his thinking on the havoc he has wrought upon our democracy. All that and more on today's program. We may even, ladies and gentlemen, we may even get to your phone calls earlier than normal in the actual unfun half, which may be a little more fun than normal today. Maybe we'll just do a teaser Tuesday on Wednesday. I'm not even sure. We'll have to see.
It's all conceivable.
Today's show is sponsored by Howl.fm. Howl's a brand new app and website that changes the way you think about podcasts. With Howl Premium, you get exclusive access to dozens of original miniseries, audio documentaries, and comedy albums. All the archives from WTF with Marc Maron and all the Earwolf shows like Comedy Bang Bang or How Did This Get Made? The Howl originals are truly unique. As a listener of the Majority Report, you should take a look at the Howl Religion, The Truth with Jerry Minor. You might remember Jerry Minor from SNL. Jerry, I don't know if you do, but I tried to get him in pilot season, actually. And for some reason, like, he said he would do it, and he just never showed up. I don't know exactly what was behind that, but he's very, very funny. And what you don't know about him, he was raised a Jehovah's Witness, just like the Reverend Dr. Ben Carson.
I'm a Seventh-day Adventist.
Oh, sorry. All right. Well, yeah, fair enough.
Liberal media.
Okay. In this three-part series, Jerry Minor reveals what it's like to grow up a Jehovah's Witness, and he thinks critically about religion free of birthdays and holidays that still looms over his relationship with his mother and, in some small ways, his life today. You can get all access to all of this exclusive content on your iPhone, your Android phone, and on the web for only $4.99 a month. So with the promo code MAJORITY, you get a full month free trial. To redeem your promo code, make sure you create your account on the web at howl.fm and enter the code MAJORITY at checkout. So go to howl.fm. That's howl, as in what a wolf does, right? H-O-W-L. They don't spell it, but they do howl. FM. All right, let's go ahead into these election results. Not very great. And, you know, the prognosticators, at least those who were looking at the polls, thought that Jack Conway was going to win in Kentucky. And just to give you a sense, I think he was up by, in some polls, by like 10 points.
As soon
or maybe up by two or three. And then he lost by 11.
As Cliff said he would win, I got scared.
Well, yeah, Cliff's record in Kentucky. But I think a lot of people were surprised because yeah. Matt Bevin lost badly to McConnell. Or not necessarily badly, but didn't lost in the primary. The Republican establishment was lined up against him. Even the Republican Governors Association was not terribly excited about this guy. And, you know, this is one of those states where if you go back, the history of people voting for Democrats, at least locally, and by locally, I mean, you know, non-federal offices, is pretty well established. The Democrats have held the governor's mansion for all but four of the last 44 years. So this is a fairly... Now, with that said... Know that Barack Obama, I think, lost to Mitt Romney in this state by something like 20 points. So, on a federal level, anyways, the Kentucky is not terribly apt to vote for a Democrat. They loathe President Obama because, you know, I don't know. There's a longstanding tradition in Kentucky to dislike Kenya. Right, exactly. And so you have... this is what's really stunning about this, and apparently a big part of this election turned on Kim Davis. You remember her. She was the thrice married, once a child in wedlock, but not her wedlock. I honestly can't even do the math on exactly. I'm not judging. I'm judging the fact that she, Jesus said something about stones and let you be the first by throwing stones or something like that. He was very into arm strength, and she failed in that analysis. So Conway, who had run against Rand Paul, who was the attorney general, fairly popular, lost by almost 9 percentage points to Bevin. The other issue, and it's unclear to me because I've seen different reports, Bevin clearly ran against Obamacare. Now, in Kentucky, it's known as Connect with a K-Y, the state exchanges. It is a state-run exchange. It was basically... forced through in many respects by the former outgoing Democratic governor, Beshear. And so they've been trying to brand it Beshear Care in Kentucky. Apparently it didn't hold. There are 420,000 people who have health insurance. Put aside the exchange for a moment. There are 420,000 people who have health care now because Governor Beshear accepted the expansion of Medicaid. Now, Bevin at first said he was going to roll that back. Later in the campaign, he started to hedge and claim that he would maintain Medicaid, I should say, for those 420,000 people, but enroll no one else on the program. So you have a kid or as someone loses their job and becomes, of loss of income and are now living in poverty, no health insurance for you. Sorry. And it's going to get worse if he's able to roll back the exchanges, which provide subsidies for people who are living between 133% of poverty and 400% of poverty. So, and if he doesn't enroll anybody else in that Medicaid, you also have a gap between 100%, someone who is living at or below 100% of the poverty line, and 133% of the poverty line. So there's literally tens of thousands of people who stand to lose their health insurance in the event that Bevin does the minimal amount of damage that he's promised to do. And there's a lot of reason to believe he'll get pushed further because this is his brand, right? So in Kentucky, it is not as much of a sort of an electoral disaster insofar as, you know, Kentucky is a red state. It is simply a human disaster. And when you want to talk about what's wrong with Kansas, the idea that Kim Davis, in her holy war to deny marriage equality to gay people, will now essentially bring about, I mean, let's face it, when you're talking about tens of thousands of people losing their health insurance, you can be sure statistically that people are going to die. So literally, her holy war against providing marriage equality to gay people will cost lives in Kentucky. But, you know, let's not leave out the Kentucky voter in this. You know, at one point you start to contemplate that notion of like, well, all right, you know what? Maybe secession is the best thing. Let's see how Kentucky does without living with things like Social Security or Medicaid or Medicare. If it didn't cost people's lives, it would be a worthy experiment to see if they in some way would respond. Meanwhile, in Ohio, the other, I guess, most high-profile election. We had a referendum. There were two referendums. There was question two and question three. Question three, if I'm not mistaken, it was question three, legalized marijuana for recreational and medicinal use. However, it also stipulated that there would only be 10 providers or manufacturers or growers of marijuana for a 4-year period. And over the course of those 4 years, after those 4 years, it would open up. This was created a certain amount of ambivalence, I think, amongst people who were interested in seeing the legalization of marijuana in Ohio because, of course, it's an obvious monopoly. Now, from my perspective, this was a mistake. 10 outfits providing this stuff. I don't know how many provide it in Colorado, but I would be surprised if it was greater than 10. And after 4 years, the argument that, there's a bar to entry into competition because you already have 10 suppliers who've gotten the run-up. I think that's the case in a place like Colorado. I mean, I understand the aversion to creating a monopoly in this way. And I understand the aversion to it, but I think the benefits that would accrue to these people was instrumental in getting these 10 outfits to fund the referendum. Now, hopefully, maybe there's another referendum in a year. I never understood the idea of putting this referendum on a non-presidential election year. I mean, that just seems stupid to me, but I guess they thought that was the smartest approach. To me, it seems stupid because you're going to bring out a lot more people who are casually in favor of legalization. Everybody who's against legalization because they think it's going to bring about some type of, crazy bacchanal or something. I think they head to the polls. But it is your average Joe on the street who doesn't think much about politics. Should pot be legalized? Sure, why not? I think those people would have showed up on more likely to show up on an on-year election. Nevertheless, that was struck down. Question number two, which was put on there almost to defeat question number three, basically said you cannot have a financial interest in a referendum that you have funded. Now, had both passed, it's really unclear, even though the Attorney General had claimed that their reading of these two laws would have nullified question three, it's unclear as to what would have remained from question three had it passed. But now this is all moot because question three failed. So hopefully we'll see another referendum. But I want to bring this up in the context of that, because I'll tell you why it's so devastating to not have marijuana. And we spoke to Elizabeth Runig a couple of weeks ago about the implications of having marijuana illegal on a federal level, in that you cannot really run proper studies, that you cannot do trials, you cannot put regulations on the development of medical marijuana for people so that consumers of medical marijuana are sure that they're getting what they're supposed to be getting, what the size of the doses are, et cetera, et cetera. Well, here's another story. Coincidentally, coming out of Ohio, about a mom, Holly Sanford, who was suffering from extreme debilitating morning sickness and sciatic nerve damage during her pregnancy. And it was so apparently debilitating, she could not get out of bed. Her doctors wanted to prescribe her opiates for the pain, but she was worried about becoming addicted and worrying about the impact on her fetus. And if any of you have ever been pregnant or have been around a pregnant woman or an expectant parent, you're constantly checking online as to the implications of taking any drugs. And the idea that you would get prescribed opiates, very scary. So she apparently did some research online and started to research medicinal marijuana tea. She said, we did the research and the THC, the psychoactive element, doesn't reach the baby after it's metabolized through my body. So it's not like the baby's stoned, like people might think in utero. But apparently the tea made the pain and the morning sickness less severe. So their child, Nova, was born healthy and alert on September 26th. Apparently, according to their attorney, a drug test was wrongfully performed on the baby at Fairview Hospital. Now, the idea of a drug test never came up when on the birth of my two children. But I guess in Ohio, and I don't know if this is state law or what, but drug tests are administered on babies when public assistance or Medicaid is paying for the hospital services. Now, I don't know if that's Ohio statute or what. But A, the Sanfords were not on public assistance and had private insurance. And B, it's utterly repulsive, the idea that you would test these kids simply because their parents are on Medicaid. or receiving public assistance. Because I got news for you. Even if the Sanfords have private insurance, they're also getting aid from the state. If they own their own house, they're getting a mortgage tax deduction. If they're getting tax refunds, if they're getting child deductions, they're getting benefits from the state. Nevertheless, the mother said they never asked us. They tested my baby's diaper with the meconium stool. So apparently what they do is they test the kid's feces. I guess it's meconium stool, technically. The urine sample was negative, but the meconium stool tested positive for a byproduct of marijuana. I guess it's not actually feces. It's just like the baby ingests so much of the stuff inside of the womb that they poop it out. It's yellow. It's gross. So despite court records documenting a normal delivery and that the baby was very healthy at birth, and records that show there was no evidence the child was exposed to THC or suffered from withdrawal, the state took their baby from them. They were told they can leave the hospital, but the baby cannot. So the couple was able to get their child placed with a family member with the help of their attorney, but they still don't have custody of this newborn infant. It's impossible for me to imagine something that is more effed up than this. They drug tested the mother. It's clear that she is not a drug addict. There is no danger to the baby. None of this should have happened in the first place. They don't test to see if the mother's been drinking during. This is just absurd. It's just absurd. They don't test a whole myriad of other things. This is just absurd. Right-wing bigotry. And now this kid, I don't know. I mean, hopefully they'll get custody of the child soon. But the idea that you would separate this baby from her mom over this is just absurd and quite a, I don't know, ironic is really the word, but quite a sort of disturbing coincidence on the day after Ohio has decided not to legalize marijuana. Meanwhile, other races across the country, in Houston, there has been an ongoing battle for an existing anti-discrimination ordinance. Apparently a year ago, the city council had passed a measure. I guess it was basically in May. It was an anti-discrimination ordinance that basically said you could not have bias in housing, employment, city contracting, and business services for 15 protected classes, including race, age, sexual orientation, and gender identity. I imagine religion's in there, a couple others. Apparently, after the city council passed it in May, it was involved in a lengthy court fight. It put the matter to referendum. Opponents said the measure would allow men claiming to be women to enter women's bathrooms and presumably inflict harm. I found one case in Canada a couple of years ago where a guy claimed to be a transgender woman and had gone into bathrooms and had serially molested women and I think a minor in the bathroom. But there's also tens of thousands, probably hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of cases of non-fake transgender women molesting other women and children. And so the idea that this is actually sort of something that this ordinance could have turned on is just bizarre, but for the fact that this is Houston. So sadly, the bigotry won out in Houston. It was a pretty acrimonious fight. And I don't know what happens next. It was the Houston Equal Rights Ordinance, and it failed. Opponents of the measure claimed that the ordinance had nothing to do with discrimination and was about the mayor's gay agenda being forced on the city. Apparently, the mayor is the largest. Houston is the largest city in the United States to elect an openly gay mayor back in 2009 when she won. Apparently, she's been very slow in pushing that gay agenda. I don't know what's going on. Maybe is that why everybody in Houston wears cowboy hats? Because the gay agenda has been successful?
How dare you?
Is that what the cowboy hats is about?
Oh,
I was wondering
mocking
about
their heritage, Sam. It's disgusting. But that's what it always is. I mean, this is Chris Christie didn't say exactly the same thing, but when he refused to revise, I think it was driver licenses laws to reflect transgender people, he talked about random anecdotes. Or Mike Huckabee made that ridiculous comment a couple of months ago about, well, what's going to happen is that boys are just going to go into girls' locker rooms because they want to, and they're going to say they're women in order to do it. And that's how they make policy. They make policy off of anecdote and bigotry.
It really is amazing, you know, just sort of like you compare this to the argument 10 years ago that, well, you can't have the military. You can have gays in the military because they'll be in the same shower.
Right.
Apparently, the idea is that men are all pathological. And if they're gay or they're straight, the only time this molestation happens is when it involves actually non-discrimination against someone because of their sexual orientation or because of their sexual identity, their gender identity. Apparently, this doesn't happen at any other time. I mean,
no, in fact, besides that, it's actually vastly exaggerated and mostly a lie.
And yes, and we should also say,
yeah,
maybe it's time to outlaw priests, right? I mean, honestly, if that's what we're really concerned about, why are we messing around and fiddling at the edges over this stuff?
Well, fiddling at the edges is what we don't want.
Exactly.
Yeah. God, Sam. Stay on point.
So that is the big, I mean, Salt Lake City elects its first openly gay mayor. That's a good news. The Democrats win their largest New Jersey assembly majority in 36 years in, thank you, Chris Christie.
And that's amazing because there can't be that much room to grow that majority on. I mean, their legislature is pretty solidly Democratic.
Yes.
That means you're eating into other parts of the state.
That's right.
That's a big rejection of Chris Christie.
Big rejection of Chris Christie.
Big.
In Maine and Seattle, there were clean elections measures that were passed. In Maine, it restores the small donor public financing system. It strengthens disclosure and enforcement requirements. In Seattle, voters said yes to creating the first in the nation system that will democratize city elections by giving every voter a chance to invest in political campaigns through a democracy voucher program. So that's, again, I think public funds being used to finance campaigns. Also in Seattle, we were asking about this yesterday, Shama Sawant. Shama Sawant was reelected. She is the socialist member of the city council. That's right. Your buddy also ran, right? Lewiston, Maine. What did he do?
Well, yeah, he wasn't. I mean, I knew him very, not very well in college, but a kid I went to Bates with, his name is Ben Chin. He became a community organizer, stayed in Lewiston after college, which is a town that, you know, I guess it's sort of like a tiny version of kind of that Yale New Haven dynamic, I guess, where you have like this very privileged college in a town that has a lot of problems. It's deindustrialized. There's a lot of racial conflict and tension with the Somali refugee community and immigrant community. Anyways, he ran for mayor against a conservative Republican, and he ran on an affordable housing agenda, an anti-racism agenda, and basically, like, this mayor of Lewiston is almost like a Paul LePage mayor. His main focus has been welfare fraud, essentially. So, and they're going into a runoff. And then the other big piece of that election was that there were racist banners about Ben Chin. He's Asian descent.
Me that.
They were literally like red banners with a caricature of Ho Chi Minh saying, like, don't vote for welfare Chin.
Wasn't it something like Fu subtle. Manchu? Like they
Fu
did...
Manchu, yeah. Yeah, they weren't that. And what basically
I'm really surprised to hear that Lewiston, Maine isn't more sort of progressive and worldly than that.
Yeah, it's shocking. Well, but what happened, the guy who did it was a slumlord. You know, you could see like in the houses around the campus, there's a lot of just really, really bad housing situations. And it's like, you know, for some college kid to be like, yeah, I'm going to live in a kind of funky apartment for a couple of years, whatever. But then there's a lot of family living in these homes,
right,
and the heat is a problem and everything. So this guy, this slumlord, was released on a list of top slumlords in the state by this organization that Ben worked with. And his revenge was to put up a banner with these Asian characters of Ben Chin. But they're going into a runoff, and he might actually pull it out and win.
How many other people were running in the race that a runoff becomes relevant?
I don't know how many other people were in the race. I just know that they were both in the early 40s, and you needed to clear 50 in order to avoid a runoff. And the final, it's going to be in December. It'll be decided. And there's a lot of tension. Like in the, there's you know, some locals telling Bates students at the polling place, like, you shouldn't be voting here type of thing. So it's kind of escalating a lot of that, those tensions that are already there.
Well, the in Worcester, the Democrat won. Apparently, there was some attempt to, I don't know, turn the Worcester mayor seat conservative. I don't know what that means. I mean, Worcester mayor is not exactly a powerful position in Massachusetts. My old high school buddy, though, was the mayor for a couple of years. He was very good. Now he works for Jim McGovern.
Oh, nice.
Oh, yeah.
Jim McGovern, good congressman.
Great congressman. All right, I want to get into this this charter school story. I mean, maybe you've seen the broad outlines. I'm not going to spend too much time on it, but there was a New York Times piece. You'll all recall that movie, Waiting for Superman, which I watched a version of it called The Lottery. It was virtually the same movie, and apparently there was a lot of like charter school money slushing around at that time that would promote these films and probably finance them, frankly. A lot of this charter school money comes from hedge funders and wealthy elite people. I mean, that's just the reality of it. I mean, and to be fair, there are public schools where there's a lot of money involved, too. I'm going to there's a comedy fundraiser tonight for my daughter's elementary school that Janine is doing, and Benjamin apparently too big to do something like this, but John Glazer and Wyatt Cynic and a couple others who Eugene Merman are doing, and you know, this is a school that gets the PTA raises a lot of money. Charter schools, I think, end up raising more because there's also a lot of for-profit guys around there. Nevertheless, one of the big arguments, one of the biggest sort of, I guess, powerhouses in charter schools, and you'll recall that she got into a big battle with Bill de Blasio, and Andrew Cuomo swooped in and championed her cause, partly because he got a lot of money from the guy from Home Depot. I can't remember his name now. What is it?
Is it Langone?
No, Ken Langone, to support charters. And she runs the Success Academy franchises of charter schools. And there was a piece in the New York Times about a Success Academy Fort Greene school. Fort Greene's a part of Brooklyn that's actually, again, a stone's throw from here. And according to documents and interviews obtained by the New York Times, the interviews were with 10 current and former Success employees at five schools, suggest that administrators at these schools have singled out children they want to kick out of the schools because there are either problems, you know, disciplinary problems or just learning problems. This school in Fort Greene, apparently, somehow the Times got hold of a got to go list with 16 students named essentially for the administrators to get to quit the school. And they did this by a combination, according to the parents, by a combination of harassment of the children, of making it difficult for the parents. Apparently, nine of the students on the list at this Fort Greene school withdrew from the school. Some of the parents said their lives were upended by repeated suspensions and frequent demands that they pick up their children early or meet with school or network staff members. Four of the parents said the school or network employees told them explicitly that the school, whose oldest students are now in the third grade, was not right for their children and they should go elsewhere. The current and former employees said they had observed similar practices at other Success schools. And according to those employees who spoke on a condition of anonymity, school leaders and network staff members explicitly talked about suspending students or calling parents into frequent meetings as ways to force parents to fall in line or prompt them to withdraw their children. Last year, the principal of Success Academy Harlem told teachers to not automatically send annual re-enrollment forms to certain students because the schools did not want those students to come back. Now, what's problematic about this? The challenge with education is how do you teach all the kids who show up at school? How do you develop a curriculum? How do you deal with kids who are coming from varying levels and varying types of socioeconomic backgrounds in one class? How do you deal with kids who are coming from poverty, even if the whole class is our kids who are coming from families living in poverty? How do you deal with kids who are coming from family situations that are messed up? How do you deal with kids who have behavioral problems because of their circumstances? That is one of the biggest challenges to education. I mean, you can go into the suburbs and you can find schools that are full of kids who come from upper middle class families, and the schools are going to be performing extremely well. The question is, how do you deal? And you can also, you can go into neighborhoods with a high incidence of poverty, and if you are able to self-select who gets to come to your school, in other words, you say, only parents who are engaged in this process can have their kids come to our school. Because that's what you're saying. When you say lottery, that's what you're saying. You're saying only kids who are lucky enough to have parents who are very engaged in the process. Because I can tell you right now, I'm going through middle school, a choice. And there's some that are lottery schools. There are some. It is a nightmare. And it costs money. It costs money because we've got to hire a babysitter so we can go on tour our schools. Or we've got to be fortunate enough that we don't each work two jobs, my wife and I. So it's difficult. There is a bar to entry just to go and put your kid into the system to have an opportunity to go to these schools. And so you get to self-select on some level. Kids who are coming from homes where the parents are are at least tuned in and involved. And then on top of that, you're still saying, like, we can't even if we get this statistical, like, outlier here or there, kids who are difficult to deal with out of that context, we're going to kick them out. This is supposed to be what charters are supposed to do, to learn how to and experiment with means in which you educate all the kids in the school. And this is running completely contrary to it. And also, you know, Eva Moskowitz comes out and says, this is an outlier. Never happened before. But of course, this whole report says this is their modus operandi. On top of all this, it's also starting to examine the fact that kids who go to these schools, they are basically, it's basically like a military regiment. The kids have to sit there. They have to have their hands folded in a specific way on the top of the desk. I mean, look, the bottom line is that people in higher economic stratas would never allow their kids to go through this type of stuff. Never. And the schools that, you know, like the private schools that kids, they don't do this. But in these charter schools, this is basically the trade-off. And the bottom line is that, and this is also coming on the heel of, I don't know if people have followed this story, but I don't know, it was about a month ago, that the Success Academy published the disciplinary record of a 10-year-old child in retaliation because the child's mother appeared on a PBS program critical of Success Academy. And it is probably an illegal act to publish a 10-year-old's disciplinary record from a public school. But a Success Academy spokesperson told Michelle Goldberg, who had written a piece on it, that the act of publishing the record was necessary because somebody deliberately appeared on national television to defame our educators, and we had to bring the truth out or let this incendiary and defamatory report stand. How effed up is that? Can you imagine what would happen to a principal of a public school if something like that happened? I mean, give me a break.
That's like they learned from Rudy Giuliani when he released, I forget the man's name, but he was murdered
right
by the NYPD. And part of the spin campaign was releasing his juvenile record.
Yep.
It's disgusting. And I remember waiting for Superman, and how part of what made that compelling just and manipulative as a movie was that it followed these likable kids. Imagine if you made a movie about likable, engaging kids who were trying their best, who were being bullied by teachers and administrators and drummed out of a charter school and held back from being with their friends and getting their full education. I mean, you can make a compelling movie just about this alone, this kind of abuse that these students faced, to being on a got-to-go list when you're 7 years old.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
It's disgusting.
It's unbelievable. And look, you know, it's a difficult situation. My daughter, when she was in kindergarten, there was a kid in that class who was incredibly disruptive. And the parents refused to acknowledge that the kid was disruptive. They literally had to have the teacher had to call security on this kindergarten kid because he was flipping tables over. Flipping tables over.
Did you do that, Matt?
And
were you a table flipper?
Every once in a while.
Michael was, but fortunately for his folks, it was in his own kitchen.
Why would that be fortunate for them? That doesn't make any sense.
They
buddy.
Didn't have to go to school to deal with it. Now, there's also a lot of now, you should know that there is a lot of research coming out now that is showing that zero tolerance school discipline policies, which are very big in the charter world, are now being found to have a disadvantage, a bad impact, basically, on a student's ability to learn. No studies show that an increase in out-of-school suspension and expulsion reduces disruption in the classroom, and some evidence suggests the opposite effect. This is according to a Vera analysis, apparently a study. Research shows a single suspension or expulsion doubles the odds a student will be required to repeat a grade, and being held back a grade is among the strongest predictors of dropping out. So there's a lot of evidence that these practices that success engages in is detrimental. I mean, I'm not convinced that if you give a rival to Success Academy the same funding, and now a lot of their funding comes from private fundraising efforts. I understand that, but that's just proof that this is not, you can't replicate this success across the board. 6% of New York students go to charter schools. You know, you have to begin to wonder what the value of these programs are if they're not producing experiments and teaching strategies that are scalable. What is the value of this? But we've gone over and did not have a chance to talk about a couple of the things. There's a great story about arbitration. We may or may not get to it. But New York Times has done a series on arbitration and the dangerous impacts of arbitration built into contracts. We'll talk more about this in the future. Of course, we've talked about this a lot when we go down to that tort conference in Vegas. And also, not to toot a horn here, but... Go back in 2014, a little more than a year ago, on June 18th of 2014, we interviewed Lena Khan, who had written a piece for the Washington Monthly on the proliferation of these arbitration clauses. You'll recall that was a big case in 2013 that we had talked about in California involving AT&T. You've got all these. There's really basically two types of really... I would put these arbitration clauses in two sort of classifications. One is where an arbitration clause like, okay, AT&T is ripping everybody off by, let's say, $3. Now, you can't get a lawyer to sue AT&T on your behalf for $3, even if it's $3 a month. And so the idea is let's all join a class. There's 100,000 or 200,000 or a million AT&T customers who've been ripped off for $3 a month for 4 years. You're talking now millions of dollars. You will find an attorney who will take that on contingency where they get 30% or 33% as a fee if it pays off. Well, AT&T, in that contract they send you, which none of you, and I include myself in this, have read. But you hit, I agree, because you don't have 3 hours to read this thing and then also 3 years to go get a law degree and then also the money to go hire a lawyer, which would it would take to understand what's in that contract. So you hit, I agree, on your computer, or you sign it at the store. And in that clause, it says that if there's any dispute as to whether or not we're illegally charging you or overcharging you, we got to go to arbitration on an individual basis. Now, are you going to do that for $3 a month? Or what? No. And the Supreme Court decided that these people cannot join a class because in each instance, AT&T overcharged them in a different way, even though it's a practice to overcharge them. And it basically excludes people from the courtroom. The other one is in the context of employment, where it gives no redress to employees if they are in any way being abused. Now, we have arbitration contracts with all the employees here at Majority Report Central. But that's basically because I want to run roughshod over them. They had no choice. They just signed it, or it was out the door. Fortunately, there's a big case involving Uber on the West Coast, which could really wreak havoc on these employment contracts because the National Labor Relations Board is getting involved, and there are other things. We'll talk about that in the future. But we're going to take a break. I guess it's not Teaser Wednesday today. This is like Bonus Wednesday.
Oh, never-ending bonuses.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. A reminder, because the members demanded it, if you're a member, you will no longer have to listen to all of La Poupée in the podcast. We cut it short in the podcast. We may even change the, I don't know. Film Guy Matthew wants me to change it to Pilot Light. I don't think we'll do that. But just a reminder, it is you who makes this show possible. Your membership allows us to do the show on a daily basis. And as a thank you, we give you some extra content every day. So, you know, you don't want to listen to the interview that day. You just want to hear Michael do Ben Carson. You can go and listen in the members thing. So become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Buy the Majority Report blend. If you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Number 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. You can IM the show. Also, keep an eye out. We're going to be sending out some email blasts soon about how you can help promote the show through something NPR is doing. Yes, stay tuned. Tomorrow on the program, Joy Reid. See you in the fun half.